Biden, the insult and injury and offense was so deliberate and so wide ranging that for example, in Dearborn, Michigan, where something like 80% of voters voted for Biden in 2020, this time, if I'm not mistaken, Trump received more votes than Harris. So you had a situation where people knew exactly what the alternative to Harris would be, but found the Democrats and their campaign and their candidate so offensive that they couldn't even bring themselves to vote to stop an alternative that many of them felt, at least on domestic issues, would be considerably worse. They couldn't hold their nose because genocide for many of them was simply a moral and political red line that they refused to cross. The second point on the election is it's really the first time in modern American history that people started speaking about Arab Americans and to a lesser extent Muslim Americans as a constituency that could have an impact on the elections one way or the other. In the end, I think that turned out not to be the case, again, because Trump's margin of victory was so large, but it'll be interesting to watch the extent to which attention is paid to this constituency moving forward. Now, with respect to Trump's Middle East policy, I'll just make a few comments. And the first is that I think it's particularly difficult to make confident predictions about foreign policy when discussing leaders as erratic and unpredictable as Donald Trump. And a second point is there are significant differences in both the Middle East and Washington when you compare 2024 to 2016 or 2020, the years of the first Trump administration. And I think the contradictions are most evident with respect to Iran. And this is something that in turn will influence U.S. policy on other regions as well. If we can just go back to Trump's first term, you'll remember that the interests and positions of Israel and Washington's Arab client regimes were largely in alignment. They uniformly supported a policy of persuading Washington to unilaterally renounce the JCPOA, the Iran Nuclear Agreement, and they were all strongly in favor of Trump's policy of maximum pressure against Iran. The situation is very different today. It's substantially different because you now have a situation where you have Israel on the one hand as an open advocate of military escalation against Iran, while Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf Cooperation Council states are promoting de-escalation because they look at Israel, which they previously viewed as a reliable security partner, particularly in relation to Iran. They now see in Israel that from their point of view is determined to set the region aflame. And they have memories of Trump's first term where Iran and its allies, for example, Ansarullah in Yemen, were launching missiles and drones at Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Then Iran conducted the sophisticated attack against the Aramco facilities in Saudi Arabia. And the Trump administration did nothing in their defense. And they now feel that if Israel has its way in setting the region aflame, it's going to be them more than Israel or the United States that is going to bear the brunt of any such conflict. And I think the just concluded Arab League Organization of Islamic Cooperation Summit in Riyadh is quite telling. In 2023, it would go no further than simply saying that humanitarian aid needs to be delivered to the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Now you have Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, openly accusing Israel of genocide. This conference calling for weapons embargoes against Israel and other measures against Israel. And I would argue just as importantly, coming out with statements openly supporting Iran's sovereignty and coming out against any further Israeli attacks against Iran. You can say this is just rhetoric, but I think it does give a good indication of the shift in the region's priorities. Now, how does this affect the situation in Palestine? Well, it's all interconnected. The higher the tensions and escalation with Iran, that will give us an indication that the influence of Israel on the one hand and the U.S. hawks on Iran, that they're kind of in the ascendancy. And this will then translate into giving Israel greater leeway in the Gaza Strip with respect to annexation in the West Bank and its various other policies. If, on the other hand, the Gulf states decide to try to deploy their influence with the Trump administration to de-escalate rather than escalate, and Saudis, for example, were to tell the Trump administration there will be no normalization agreement, there will be no reduction in our relations with China unless you hold Israel in check, well, that may well also translate into realities, different realities in Palestine as well. So there's kind of this competition for influence. We'll have to see if Arab states, out of a sense of self-preservation, if nothing else, seek to use their influence. And if they do seek to do so, how successful will they be? Finally, Bassem, you mentioned the names that are being mentioned for senior national security and foreign policy positions in the Trump administration. It's really a rogue's gallery. But again, we have to consider to what extent these people will be able to take Washington's policy in the Middle East in directions that Trump may not necessarily be on board with. I mean, Trump's hostile instincts towards Arabs, towards Muslims, against Iran, against Palestinians, those are well known. But he also has a significant isolationist and anti-war constituency and may, on the one hand, you know, want to see regime change in Tehran, but also hesitate on becoming, on the United States, becoming directly involved in a Middle East war that would make Iraq look like child's play. And as far as these appointments are concerned, if reports that Marco Rubio is going to be the next Secretary of State turn out to be true, is that really that different than Antony Blinken? The way I see the main difference between Rubio and Blinken, they will both support Israeli annexation. They will both fully support continuing the genocide in Gaza. But Rubio will do so in a straightforward manner. Blinken will come out with his earnest mendacity and tell you there needs to be more humanitarian aid. We oppose annexation while supporting it, and so on. So the final point I would make is that it's not only the policy instincts and what the various parties in the Middle East do that will be decisive, but just as importantly, the situation that exists in the region on January 20th, 2025, when the Trump administration takes office. What happens in the next 2 months and what the situation is like at the end of these 2 months will, I think, have a very significant impact on where things proceed later. Will there still be a war in Lebanon? Will there be escalation or de-escalation with Iran? Will Israel have started building settlements or annexing Gaza Strip and West Bank territory? So we also need to look at the actual concrete realities on the ground in January to get a better understanding of where things will be heading for the next 4 years. Thank you.
What you just heard were the remarks of Ma'in Rabbani, a researcher, analyst, and commentator specializing in Palestinian affairs, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the contemporary Middle East, delivered at the Trajectories of U.S. Middle East Policy, Continuity, and Change, hosted by Jedaliyah on November 12, 2024. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Let's listen next to the remarks of Jamil Muawad, Assistant Professor of Politics and Policy at the Department of Political Studies and Public Administration at the American University of Beirut, delivered at the same Trajectories of U.S. Middle East Policy, Continuity and Change panel. And the voice you will hear first is that of the moderator, Omar Dahi.
Jamil, I'm going to introduce you formally in a second, but I also want you to take us a little bit back, to kind of give us a context of where we are in terms of this past two decades of U.S. policy. And I'll ask you specifically to comment on how this is viewed from within Lebanon. But to introduce you formally, since we haven't done so yet, Dr. Jamil Muawad is Assistant Professor of Politics and Policy at the Department of Political Studies at the American University of Beirut. He's also a founding member of the Beirut Critical Security Studies Group, the Beirut School of Critical Security Studies. Jamil, specifically, I wanted to ask you, since you have you've been closely following and commentating and writing about Lebanese domestic politics, and also obviously observer and kind of researcher on, like many of us looking at U.S. policy in the region, how those two interact. So, how does U.S. policy, especially over the past two decades, how did it evolve towards Lebanon, and how is it viewed from Lebanon? How does it shape the reactions of political elites and political forces in Lebanon? So we can understand how basically there's this interplay between both sides, and in many ways, how it kind of structures the incentives, so to speak, to use in economics terms, in various ways in terms of political discourse and political actions.
Yes, thanks, Omar. Thanks, Bassam, for hosting me. And thanks, Moeen, for this basically overview. I'm talking to you right now from Beirut. And I'd like also to analyze how do possibly us in the region interact with American foreign policy, and what implications does it have on Lebanese politics. So I'd like to explore a bit this entanglement between the global dynamic and the local dynamic, and what impact does it have on Lebanon and on the region. So, but I'd like to start first and argue that the USA doesn't really have a clear and comprehensive foreign policy toward Lebanon as a country or as a state. What the states has alternatively is a policy that has been primarily focused on Hezbollah per se and not on Lebanon. So we can rather talk about a Hezbollah-centered foreign policy, American foreign policy. And this Hezbollah-centered focus is one rooted in the trauma of the 1983 embassy and Marine Barracks bombing in Beirut that killed over 240 U.S. Military personnel, and in which Hezbollah was accused of basically implementing. And two, this Hezbollah-centered focus is reinforced by the view of Hezbollah as an Iranian proxy in the region, which I believe turned and made Hezbollah a primary concern in the U.S. broader strategy in the Middle East over the past two decades, often overshadowing Lebanon's national interest and also concerns. So what are the pillars or the main pillars of this Hezbollah-centered American foreign policy? First, we have the war on terror. Of course, as you all know, since at least the 80s, the USA has designated Hezbollah as a terrorist group. But this has gained traction after 9/11 and the Iraq War in 2003, with the intensification of the focus on militarily disarming Hezbollah, but also politically, if I may say, politically marginalizing the group in Lebanon. And in this context, we've seen the adoption of two main UN resolutions, UN Resolution 1559 in 2004 and 1701 in 2006, that were endorsed by the USA and aimed at curtailing Hezbollah's influence in Lebanon and the region. These measures reinforce the global view of Hezbollah as a destabilizing force in Lebanon and in the region. And we no longer talk about Hezbollah as a local political and military organization with deep roots in Lebanese society. So I quote here a very interesting article by Karim Madisi, in which he argues that the war on terror effectively transformed the global struggle over U.S. hegemony in the region, into a deeply rooted and fundamentally local power conflict. And this is when the country basically got split between two camps, March 8, pro-West March 14, and pro-Iranian and Syrian March 8. And of course, this was directly reflected on the local landscape, where since then Hezbollah was considered, at least by the pro-West March 14 alliance, as a militia. They started to use the word militia, and no longer as a mukawama or a resistance, which was the case in the 90s. So this is something that has actually changed the whole political dynamic in the country, with the main political divide revolving primarily around who's pro-Hezbollah and who's anti-Hezbollah. And this came to the detriment of many other serious issues, mainly economic and political reform. So the focus was strictly on Hezbollah, and this is a clear reflection on the global war on terror back then. The second pillar is, of course, funding civil society. Since at least the mid-2000s, the U.S. has invested a lot in what they call democracy support programs in Lebanon, and they implemented these programs deliberately to exclude Hezbollah. So as you all know, because Hezbollah is a terrorist organization, they cannot benefit from our fund. And this had, of course, implications, because this selective approach didn't only bolster some political factions and civil society groups, but also contributed to marginalize Hezbollah, but also to diabolize Hezbollah as an external body to the Lebanese social fabric. And here, you know, between two brackets, this democracy support, as endorsed and promoted by the Americans, is very top-down. A very top-down approach to civil society, versus a very grassroots understanding of politics when it comes to Hezbollah. So we were witnessing kind of two contradictory approaches to change, but also to societies. One that is very top-down, and the other one that is very grassroots, of course, with an Islamist identity. So, of course, this didn't only compromise pro-democracy or pro-change groups, but most importantly, Hezbollah grew suspicious of many organic social movements in Lebanon, judging them, or at least the movements themselves, for being driven, endorsed, or supported by the Americans. And this is particularly the case of October 17 movement, when that was a very organic movement at the beginning, and Hezbollah basically didn't really trust this movement, thinking that this is a U.S.-driven movement. And that's when Hezbollah started to label some of the groups as the Embassies Club or Jamiat al-Safarat. So this had a very negative consequence on the organic and not necessarily affiliated groups. They're not affiliated with any embassy. And this compromised at least social movements in Lebanon because of this tension between pro-West democracy support and Hezbollah's perception of this support. The third pillar, as you all know, is the economy. For a long time, the Americans, they really focused on the banking sector in Lebanon and, you know, of course, sanctioning some individuals closely or remotely affiliated with Hezbollah. But when it comes to the banking sector, all their OFAC policies, they were implemented by Riyad Salami, the former head of the central bank, who was no one else but the protege of the Americans. And you all know that the banking sector in Lebanon is extremely corrupt. But because of this U.S. protection of Salami, it was really very difficult to render this banking sector accountable. And the Lebanese society basically paid the price for this lack of accountability with the financial collapse in 2019, in which the banking sector is, you know, a main, basically, drive for this collapse. Now Salami is no longer protected by the Americans because he's no longer relevant. That's why he's in jail. There is another kind of sanctions driven by the American foreign policy, which is when the Americans blocked the gas supply to Lebanon from Egypt via Syria, when Lebanon was in need, basically, of this supply because, you know, of shortage of electricity and fuel. So when they really needed the most this gas supply, basically, the Americans sanctioned it, allegedly, because it goes via Syria, and, you know, they have to abide by the Caesars Act sanctions. So this illustrates to a great extent how U.S. so-called counterterrorism policies, they intersect with economic measures, but also they do directly affect the country's politics, but also economic landscape. So the fourth pillar, which is something that is going right now, the conflict between and the war between Israel and Lebanon. We all know that the U.S. has led some initiatives in order to find a solution for this, or ceasefire, or solution for this war. And Amos Hochstein, who's the U.S. envoy to Lebanon, he himself is not partial. So even this foreign policy of the Americans is very biased, because the envoy is not partial, because he, the guy, served at the Israeli army, and politicians, the interlocutors of Hochstein, didn't really trust him, and some of them explicitly said that he bluffed us in the past year, because he always gave us reassurance that Israel won't escalate its war against Lebanon, we won't go for an all-out war, and he promised them, so they felt kind of, you know, comfort, until, of course, Israel didn't respect this this rule, and they did assassinate Hassan Nasrallah. And some of these politicians, they do blame Hochstein directly for being, you know, basically not trustworthy. And there is a running joke in Lebanon that at some point when they were negotiating, when Amos Hochstein was negotiating with Nabih Berri, the Speaker of the House, who is Shia, he promised him the Shia votes in Michigan in return for a ceasefire. So there is kind of this transnational in Lebanon that became all of a sudden, through all fourth, became all of a sudden a main actor in U.S. Elections. And I believe Moin mentioned this briefly, not when it comes to the Lebanon, but also the Arab vote in general. So these four pillars that are very driven towards Hezbollah and not towards the country had, of course, internal consequences in Lebanon. As I mentioned first, U.S. Policies have contributed to shifting. I mean, they're not only responsible party for this, but they contributed to shifting public perceptions when it comes to Hezbollah in Lebanon. So originally, as I said, the party was seen as a resistance movement, but after that period, many now view Hezbollah as a militia, which further polarized the society and deepened the internal divisions in the country, to the detriment of, you know, state institutions. And this contributed to undermining state institutions. So how do the Lebanese interact with this policy? It's a very ad hoc kind of interaction. Of course, always when it revolves around who's pro-Hizb and who's against the Hizb. And for years, we saw some politicians, local politicians, mobilizing their network and connections within the U.S. administration for internal dynamics and to get some gains internally. So we see a lot of politicians in the past 10 years hosting, for instance, at their own dinners, someone like Mike Pompeo, and presenting themselves as the ally, quote-unquote, of the Americans and the favorite of the Americans nationally, and presenting themselves as a favorite American candidate, which is not true. So all these dynamics, they were mobilized internally, of course, always by really reinforcing this polarization to the detriment of the society, but also by sidelining state institutions. And there is something, there is a key point here, I believe, to bring on the table, which is change in Lebanon as perceived now by Hezbollah as a U.S.-led movement and not necessarily a Lebanese-led movement. So, of course, the Americans are not only responsible for this, the Lebanese themselves, the Lebanese politicians are also complicit in this dynamic, but this contributed greatly, I believe, to compromise or to belittle the role of a Lebanese-led movement for change by alienating Hezbollah further and maybe pushing the party more and more into the Iranian axis, because this discourse started to label Hezbollah as a regional actor more than a local or a national actor. And this perhaps also explains the reason why Hezbollah intervened in Syria at some point. So currently now, of course, many politicians, they're very happy that Boulos Massad, a failed politician basically in Lebanon, who ran for elections a couple of years ago and went, and now he's the in-law of Trump. They see in Boulos Massad as really the hope for bringing about change in Lebanon. And this shows how flat this interaction is and how flat their understanding of politics and U.S. Foreign policy is as well. So to conclude with a couple of remarks, the U.S. foreign policy is not Lebanon-oriented foreign policy, is a Hezbollah-oriented foreign policy. And this contributed to exemplify a broader regional strategy for the Americans that often overlooks local complexities. As a friend, you know, told me, who happened to work at the embassy for years, he told me that the Americans don't really understand Lebanon, and they will never understand Lebanon. Of course, this makes us, you know, believe that their foreign policy basically failed, because all the attempts to minimize or undermine the role of Hezbollah didn't really succeed in Lebanon. In a nutshell, the country has become collateral damage for this dynamic. The focus on Hezbollah it made Lebanon a collateral damage. And in this sense, I believe that the current and ongoing war against Lebanon, the U.S.-backed Israeli war against Lebanon, is one pillar of the four or five pillars that I mentioned above. The war is a war against Hezbollah, and because previous steps have failed to minimize and undermine the role of Hezbollah, they resorted to violence instead. Of course, we can link it to a regime change in Iran, and this is what Netanyahu said after the assassinated Nasrallah. He clearly said that this would change the balance of power in the region for years to come. But this war is part of many attempts by the Americans to undermine the role of Hezbollah. So this is how I see it. And finally, going back to the panel's question whether there is change or continuity, I'm afraid there is kind of an exponential continuity. At least, you know, we're all expecting more damage in the 2 months, in the coming 2 months in Lebanon until, you know, Trump takes things in charge.
What you just heard were the remarks of Jamil Mouawad, Assistant Professor of Politics and Policy at the Department of Political Studies and Public Administration at the American University of Beirut, delivered at the Trajectories of U.S. Middle East Policy Continuity and Change, hosted by Jedaliyah on November 12, 2024. There was further discussion between the moderators and the two guest speakers, and you can watch that online by visiting www.jedaliyah.com. That's JADALIYYA.com. And I have a link to that on our website, arabvoices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Ein feministisches Radio gegen patriarchale Gewalt am 25. November und jeden Tag.
Isang feministang radio laban sa patriarkong pagsasamantala.
Radia, indarkeria machistaren aurkako zure irrati feminista.
Ein feministisches Radio gegen patriarchale Gewalt am 25. November und jeden Tag.
Zusammen sind wir heute ganz speziell laut. Gegen das Patriarchat. Halten wir uns an den Händen, stehen wir zusammen auf der Straße und schreien wir gegen Feminizide, gegen Gewalt an Transmenschen und gegen ein System, das Unterdrücken am besten kann. Nicht mit uns!
Feministisch. 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 Feministisch.
Radio Lora.
Hola, mi nombre es Yara. Vivo en Bilbien. Quería, sobre todo y ante todo, agradecer y felicitar a Radio Lora por la gran labor que hacen, una labor alternativa de radio, alternativa de transmitirnos mensajes de diferentes países y también de diferentes comunidades feministas, homosexuales, lesbianas, que se sienten representadas y hacer parte de ese proyecto, incluso de poder escuchar las emisiones más tarde, es un regalo. Gracias, Radolora, lo felicito y que sigan adelante.
Lora braucht Freundinnen und Freunde. Macht mit auf lora.ch.